Hi everyone, and welcome to tonight's event, Defining the Moment, Determining Death in Halakha. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Vizier's Farm Sale for co-sponsoring tonight's event, and particularly Sarah Shabtai and Sam Ulrich for all their help. Tonight, we will hear from Rabbi Dr. David Shabtai about two topics that have become popular recently, determining the moment of death and organ donation. These two topics are heavily intertwined and have many halakhic ramifications. Rabbi Dr. Shabtai, who recently published his book on brain death, will discuss some of the issues that arise in these areas. Rabbi Dr. Shabtai is currently a fellow at the Wexner Kollel Elyon at Reit. He received his BA from Columbia, his medical doctorate from NYU School of Medicine, and rabbinic ordination from Reit. He currently teaches Jewish medical ethics at Yeshiva University and lectures on various topics in Jewish law. He is particularly interested in the interface between science, medicine, and halakha. After the lecture, Rabbi Dr. Shabtai will be signing his new book, which can be purchased for a 15% discount. At this time, I would like to present Rabbi Dr. Shabtai.
Thank you very much. Thank you. First of all, thank you, Rachel, for the introduction. Thank you to Rachel and Daniel and MES for coordinating this event, to the Sfarim Sale for hosting it. Thank you, everyone, for coming from near and far. It was very exciting for me. I started working on this book so many years ago, and to finally see it come to publication is a really momentous occasion for me. And the book was dedicated in memory of my mother, Zichrona Livracha. And while I didn't realize this when I was trying to publish it for a certain time frame, and nor when I was picking the date to speak here, her Yahrzeit does come out this Thursday. And so I'd like to dedicate this year to Le'ilui Nishmasa. And as a book that took so long to work on, there are many, many, many people that they need to be thanked, more than I can count or allow to scroll up on the screen. But to my family, to my mentors, to my teachers, my rabbeim, teachers in med school, teachers in yeshiva back in college, friends, family, really so many people who have been so supportive and in conversation and otherwise, it's just... I just don't know how to express my thanks other than just letting you know that it wouldn't have happened without everybody's help. Okay. So what I'd like to talk about tonight is determining the moment of death. Now, this is important for a number of reasons. Most basic in halacha is that death has important halachic ramifications, which it always had for millennia. Right? We need to know when the mitzvah of burial begins. It only begins once a person has died. The Jewish law insists on speedy burial, and it has to start from the moment of death. When does Shiva begin? When does the period of mourning begin? When are Kohanim prohibited from coming into contact or under the same roof as a dead person? We'll all begin at the moment of death. These have serious, serious ramifications. And in the past, it was generally assumed that this is what it was limited to. Just a quote from, not necessarily the best source, but an enlightening one nonetheless. So contrary to whenever the Princess Bride was set to be historically played, today there's a lot more we can do with the dead. Today we know, as of February 10th, unfortunately, those are the current statistics, there are in the United States alone 112,905 patients who are dying, who have some organ dysfunction, whose life could be saved by an organ transplant. I checked this morning, it was 100, they were about 10 more, 113,000, no, 112,915. If you look at the breakdown of those patients, who's waiting for which organ, kidneys are the number one needed organ far and wide. 90,883 patients as of February 10th. This is likely due to the diabetes epidemic in America, likely due to the obesity epidemic. Kidneys are the number one needed organ in this country. A dead person has two kidneys. So this is a potential source for kidney donation. Now, why do we need to make sure that a person's dead? Well, we can't take out an organ from someone who's alive if it might kill them. Right? We're not allowed to murder one person, even with the noble cause of saving somebody else. That's always forbidden. In the American law, it's known as the dead donor rule, and in halacha, it's known as lo tirtach, one of the Ten Commandments. So we're going to focus tonight on kidneys. So there are two sources for kidneys. You can have a live donor or a dead donor. Living donation can be done by a healthy person. We each have two kidneys, and we can live. A healthy person can live with only one of them. A healthy person can donate their kidney to someone who needs it and live relatively a healthy life. Statistics show that on average, the average kidney donor lives longer than the average American. Now, I think there is the scientific answer and there's the hashkafic answer to this. The scientific answer is that on average, the average kidney donor is healthier than the average American, and that's why this person was eligible to be a kidney donor. The hashkafic reason might be that, you know, this person saved someone's life, he performed the ultimate mitzvah of pikuach nefesh, and there's a certain hashkafa from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to take care of them. Regardless, live donation is a separate topic. We're going to, we just touched on it, we're not going to discuss it tonight. However, that's certainly an option. Living healthy people can donate their kidneys to people in need. Unfortunately, in the United States, that has not stemmed the tide of patients who need kidneys. As I noted before, there are 90,000 patients still needing kidneys, and I don't know how many healthy Americans out there. We're not meeting the demand. So the second way to get kidneys is from a dead donor. Now, while a healthy person can give a kidney and live a healthy life, someone who's dying or someone who's really sick, if they would operate and take out that person's kidney, it would seriously hinder their health and may actually kill them. So from a dying person or from a really sick person, we can't take out their kidney without either harming them seriously or actually killing them. So therefore, to try to make up for this loss that we have in live donation, we look towards dead donation. So where do we find kidneys from dead donors? So there are two types of dead donors that qualify for this donation. There are brain dead patients. Brain dead patients have suffered severe neurological disability, severe neurological damage. Their hearts are beating, and therefore oxygenated blood is circulating throughout their body, and therefore their organs are being kept in a fashion that enables organ donation in a very, I shouldn't say simple, but a straightforward way. Unfortunately, too, that is not quite meeting the demand of the 90,000 patients who need the kidneys. So the other way is from patients who die in the standard definition of death. And we'll talk about that in a moment. I put it in quotes to be intentionally vague. Now, why don't we just take kidneys from every dead person? Everyone dies eventually, and we just take their two kidneys out and give them to a healthy person. So the problem is that after a person dies, if they're not brain dead, if they die and their heart stops, the cells of all the organs start to disintegrate really quickly. And the longer you wait between determining the moment of death and getting that kidney out of there, you are potentially limiting the survival ability of the person who's going to get that kidney. That kidney is going to start becoming not quite as usable anymore. So what we need to do is minimize the time between the determination of death and the time we get that kidney out of there, so that once the person's dead, he doesn't need the kidney anymore. We're not harming him, and yet we've managed to get that kidney out in a way that we can save the most number of lives. So in the book, I discuss the different approaches to brain death. There is indeed a machlokas, a disagreement in the halachic community how we determine it, if we determine it, what it means, what it could mean, how it's derived from the sources, and I encourage you to read it there. What I'd like to focus tonight is on the tangentially related topic of organ donation, which has currently come into the news more frequently, of the determination of what I'm calling standard death. So how do we determine death in the United States? So the Uniform Definition of Death Act, which was posited originally by the President's Commission for the Study of Ethical Problems in Medicine and Biomedical and Behavioral Research in 1981, was accepted by almost all U.S. jurisdictions since that time. So in the United States, there are two ways that a person can meet the criteria for death. So an individual who suffers from either the irreversible cessation of circulatory and respiratory functions is dead, someone whose heart has irreversibly stopped beating and is irreversibly incapable of breathing is dead, or a separate set of criteria, the irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain, including the brain stem. So a person meeting either of these is dead. And what I'd like to focus on tonight, as I mentioned, is the first criteria. the irreversible cessation of circulatory and respiratory function. And particularly what I like to focus on is irreversibility, because I think it's pretty obvious to determine when a person's heart has stopped beating. You can look at an EKG, you can listen with a stethoscope, you can feel for a pulse. What do we know about the irreversibility, and why does that become relevant? So, in order for a person, that, given that that's a definition, we need to make sure that a person has reached that definition before we take out their organs. Given that we're not determining death by brain death, we're determining death by the first criteria, the irreversible cessation of spontaneous of circulatory and respiratory function, we're going to be talking about patients who are not brain dead. They are alive according to the law and according to all halachic poskim. So before we get into the particular protocol for how this is done, let's just try to figure it out in the standard case. So you have a patient at point A who's alive and healthy. At point B, and the clocks on the bottom don't denote a particular span of time, just that time has passed. At some point B, this person's heart stops. They suffer a heart attack. And their EKG is flat. At some point C, a little bit later, the heartbeat comes back. Okay. So at point A, I think everyone would agree that this person is alive. At point C, the person also appears to be alive. What about at point B? How do we describe this person? Do we describe him as having been dead and then coming back to life? Or we describe him as never actually having been dead because, you know, when his heart stopped, it wasn't actually irreversible. And how do I know? Well, ultimately, it reversed. And I think it's very plausible to take both opinions. I think the more intuitive way, even, is to say, look, if you're going to determine death by the irreversible cessation of leaving the word irreversible out of it for a moment, we're going to determine, define that, the cessation of circulatory and respiratory function, when you have no heartbeat and you have no, and you're not breathing, at point B, this person has no heartbeat and he isn't breathing. He meets the criteria. At point C, he comes back. Okay. This is not a notion that's foreign to Judaism, right? We believe in Tchias HaMesim. We believe that dead people ultimately will become resurrected. This is not crazy. Question, or is it? So, if we assume that he was dead and then came back to be alive, we should argue the same thing in this case, right? So, here, in point A, he was alive, and then at B, his heart stopped, C, he came back, and D, it went out again, and then E, it came back. There should be no difference, right? If he was alive and then dead, and he came back, and he was alive and then dead again. And it shouldn't matter how far, how large, how long the span of time that the patient is without a heartbeat, right? However, if you think about it for another minute, if you start shortening and shortening these intervals, you get a regular heartbeat. Because on average, a person's heart beats 70 times a minute. So 70 times a minute, my heart's not beating, right? It's only beating 7 times. At some point during that cycle, it's actually not beating. Define it how you will. But nonetheless, we're all alive. We don't die 70 times a minute. And that's because it's reversible. Our heartbeat is beating, and then it stops and beats again. And so long as the heartbeat comes back, you haven't met the criteria of being irreversible. And so long as you haven't met the criteria of being irreversible, it doesn't matter what happened in the interim. This person is alive and was always considered to be alive, never having met the criteria for death. This, in fact, is how it's defined in U.S. law. Anytime that a patient or any person has a heart rate and then it stops and then it comes back, this person is defined as having been alive retroactively and throughout that whole time. All the halachic poskim, almost without exception, assume this to be the case. So long as the heartbeat comes back, this person is retroactively determined to have been alive. The question is, well, what happens if a person's heart stops, and then only through CPR can we get the heart rate back, right? Sometimes people have a heart attack, and if we don't do anything, they might die, chas v'shalom, and we call the EMTs, we call Hatzala, and they perform CPR and bring them back. So, again, because this person's heart rate came back, his heartbeat came back, the assumption of American law, and of halacha, again, is that since it came back through a natural means meaning something either happens on its own, or through human means, this person has always been retroactively alive. There's a phenomenon in medicine known as autoresuscitation, also known as the Lazarus effect. We don't exactly know why it happens or how it happens or can predict exactly, but there are certain people who, after their heart stops, it can come back spontaneously. Sometimes it can last for a couple of seconds, sometimes for a couple of moments, sometimes for a couple of hours, and sometimes for a couple of days and weeks. We don't exactly know how long that, why that can happen. We don't exactly know, can predict when it happens. It's exceedingly rare, but it happens. But you can wait even after that time. Let's say auto-resuscitation can only happen in 5 minutes. I'm just throwing out a number. After that time, CPR can still be effective and bring back this person's heart rate. If that were to happen, so then the person would be alive retroactively, having been alive at time B also. So the question is, well, what if it's not through CPR? What if it's through what I'm calling Ruach HaKodesh? So we know that there are cases in the Tanakh of Nevi'im bringing people back to life. Right? We know there's a case of Eliyahu HaNavi with the Ben Hatzarfatis, and Elisha with the Ben HaShunamis. And so these were two young boys who, the Chasam Sofer explains, Chazal thought were actually dead, and the Nevi'im came in and resuscitated them, resurrected them, and brought them back to life. So what was their story? So the assumption of all the poskim is that because it wasn't through a natural means, this person was actually dead. And the Gemara in Nida goes so far as to wonder, Ben HaShunamis Maoshi Yitame Be'olo. The Ben HaShunamis, does he cause tumah? And the Rishonim were all bothered by that Gemara. They're like, of course he causes tumah. I don't understand. He was dead. Of course he causes tumah. There's no question that if anybody entered that room while the Ben HaShunamis or the Ben HaTzarfatis was lying there, that the Kohen, that person would become tumah and the Kohen to violate a prohibition. They explain the Gemara is referring to once he came back. Is he still mitame? Given that he once was tame, does that transfer later to when he's alive also? And the Gemara answers, no, it doesn't. But the Gemara never even had an assumption that this person should not be tame while he's dead. Because it's clear as day that this person was dead and was resurrected. It's interesting that I quote this because there's one opinion out there that tries to prove the notion of reversibility from this Gemara. That the fact that a person could be reversed proves that he was never dead. The Gemara in Bava Metzia Kuf Yudal Amar Aleph states, identifies Eliyahu HaNavi with Pinchas HaKohen. It identifies them as being the same character, the same persona. Tosfos takes this comparison very seriously and says, wait a minute, if Eliyahu HaNavi is Pinchas HaKohen, then he should have been prohibited in contracting tumah from a dead person. How could Eliyahu HaNavi have entered the room of the Ben HaTzarfatis in order to resurrect him? He violated the principle, he violated the prohibition of Tumas Kohanim. And Tosfos says, no, it's okay. It's mishum pikuach nefesh. Saving a life, it's permissible. And not only that, barur lo sheyechayehu. He was certain that he would be able to bring him back. It says pikuach nefesh and barur lo sheyechayehu. So all the commentators are bothered by this. They explain, well, the Gemara assumes that these boys were dead. If they're dead, so there's no concept of pikuach nefesh for dead people. Pikuach nefesh means to take a living person and give him more life, not a dead person. And they say, and if it was pikuach nefesh, so why barur lo sheyechayehu? Why did he have to be certain that he would be successful? We know that we're allowed to violate any prohibition in the Torah for pikuach nefesh, even if it's uncertain, even if it's only a suffix, even if we think we have a chance of saving this person's life, it should be permissible. So why does Tosfos say pikuach nefesh? That's strange. And if it is pikuach nefesh, so why barur lo sheyechayehu? It should be a suffix. So his explanation says, well, Eliyahu HaNavi, this boy was dead according to all natural science at the time and according to all natural means. However, Eliyahu HaNavi was a prophet, and he knew that he would be able to resurrect that boy. And because he knew he would be able to resurrect that boy, it qualifies as pikuach nefesh. Because he knew it would be pikuach nefesh, he wasn't dead because he was reversible. And therefore, you see from here that Tosfos are calling it pikuach nefesh because he was still considered to be alive. Problem is that Tosfos asked that he became tame, so it's a little problematic. The real problem with this explanation is, it seems to be against the pasuk in the Tanakh. When Yechezkel HaNavi has the vision of the dried bones, the Atzamos HaYaveshos, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes him to a valley and he sees all these dried bones, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu explains to him this is going to be the resurrection of Bnei Yisrael, and as a symbolic gesture of that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu resurrects these dead bones. The Karamti Leim Basar, he gives them flesh and Gidim and Atzamos, and they come together and he gives them life, and they come back to life. But before he does that, he takes Yechezkel HaNavi around to look at the bones, and it's the pasuk says, Ve'yavirani Leim Saviv Saviv. Pasuk says he took Yechezkel HaNavi around. And Rashi explains, why did he take him around? Why didn't he put him in the middle? He says, because it's Yechezkel ben Buzi HaKohen. Yechezkel was a Kohen, and he wasn't allowed to be a Metame LeMason. So, if we take our previous explanation, it's a problem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knew that he was going to resurrect these people. So if he knew he was going to resurrect them, and using the power of prophetic resurrection qualifies as reversibility, then there shouldn't have been any tumah. So you see from here, at least, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was concerned, at least according to Rashi, that a dead person who can only be resurrected through prophetic means is really dead. However, almost all the poskim assume, and what is assumed in American law, is that if a person experiences auto-resuscitation, where the heartbeat comes back on its own, or through natural means, and by natural means, I mean using modern medicine, or even ancient medicine, or using any medical means that are available to us, that person is considered to be alive retroactively. So this is no nice in theory, but who really cares? Why are we focusing on this? So as I mentioned, we really need to try to get more organs. There are a lot of people who are suffering and who could be helped if we could find another source of organs, because the brain dead patients were simply not enough to meet the demand. So there's a protocol been established called controlled donation after cardiac death. And what I'd like to do is first discuss the protocol of it, discuss what the ethics are, and then try to analyze what the halacha is. So in controlled donation after cardiac death, you have a patient who's alive, both according to American law, according to all the poskim. This patient is dying. He is on the ventilator usually, able to breathe somewhat. He needs assistance. The ventilator helps him breathe. His heart's beating. The rest of his functions are functioning normally, but he's dying. This patient has no other hope to be cured or has requested that no other therapies be initiated on his behalf. So we can't take out his organs. He still needs them. And operating on this patient will certainly kill him. So we can't take his organs. But if we could wait until the moment he died and then start taking out his organs, that would be fine. There would be no problem. There is a question of nivela mace. There is a question of desecrating a dead body. However, almost all the poskim assume that for the purpose of piguach nefesh, this is permissible. It's generally prohibited, but these are life-saving procedures. A patient who receives a kidney will live on average, depending on their condition, at least 5 to 7 years on average again, longer than he would have lived otherwise. This is a life-saving procedure, and therefore we set aside the prohibition of nivela mace for the tzarich of piguach nefesh. So what we need to do is take this patient as soon as we get him, as soon as we declare death, and try to get his organs out as quickly as possible. The problem is defining quickly as possible. So many of these patients are laying in the ICU on a ventilator, attached to a lot of tubes and machines. And if we waited until their heart stopped beating and they stopped breathing, again, these patients are not meeting criteria for brain death. So, and then rush them, then the family would say goodbye, rush them down to the operating room and started operating on them, it wouldn't work. It's too long. Taking the patient down there, prepping him for surgery, it's just not going to make it. So what we need to do is find a way for this patient to die in the operating room. The problem is you can't take every sick patient and put him in the operating room and just wait. It's just not efficient, and that likely borders on piguach nefesh, because that operating room could be used for a lot of procedures in that time that are indeed life-saving, and we don't know when this person will go. So the following protocol has been developed. So you start off with a patient who's alive and connected to a ventilator. Now this patient can likely breathe a little bit on his own, but not completely, so he needs help. So this person is fully alive and connected to a ventilator, and we take him to the operating room. And then the ventilator is removed. So we'll just note this presents the first halachic question. Can you remove a ventilator? Should you remove a ventilator? If you can, under what circumstances may you remove a ventilator? Suffice it to say that most poskim assume that ventilators should not be shut off once they are started, but for the sake of the protocol, this is what's happening. So let's just deal with the facts. So the ventilator is shut off, and this patient now no longer has any support for his breathing at time A. So because he could breathe a little bit on his own, there's some oxygen still left in his body, at time B, his heart is still going to be beating. So everyone agrees that this person is going to be alive, according to, again, both American law and all the poskim. At some point, because he can't breathe anymore, his heart will stop beating at time C, and he will have a flat line in his EKG. At that point, death is determined. In the operating room, they declare death. And then, so they wait a couple of minutes. Why a couple of minutes? Why don't they start taking the organs out immediately? Because they wait for the possibility of autoresuscitation. It's conceivable that a patient's heart will spontaneously start beating on its own. And if the patient's heart spontaneously starts beating on its own, then he was retroactively declared to be alive. So this time span spans anywhere between 2 and 5 minutes. Interestingly, it's not determined by law. It's determined by hospital policy and varies widely across the United States. In one case in New Mexico, they waited for three babies, they waited 75 seconds. That appears to be the shortest time. Most hospitals wait 5 minutes. Now they're questioning whether it should be 2 minutes or 5 minutes. How long is autoresuscitation possible? We don't really have good studies on dying patients in autoresuscitation where CPR was not initiated. So you have this patient who at time A has a heartbeat, we remove the ventilator, at time B they still have a heartbeat, at time C their heart stops, and at time D their heart is still stopped. After the time period for autoresuscitation is over, they can now remove the organs. And because we've limited that time so significantly, we can still recover at least the kidneys. The kidneys are one of the most versatile organs, can live the longest, whatever that means for kidney to live, can maintain viability the longest without a heartbeat. And like I mentioned, they're the number one organ that's necessary. So this protocol makes some sense. Hearts cannot be transplanted in this way. It's too long without oxygen supply. Lungs often cannot, livers often cannot. The focus is mostly on the kidneys. So the question is, well, what happens if, instead of cutting this guy open and removing his organs, we try to resuscitate him? So again, we took his ventilator off, he stopped breathing, or he's breathing a little bit, then he eventually stops, his heart stops, his heart's beating for a little bit, then stops. And we waited the period for order resuscitation, but as we noted earlier, it's possible for that period to end, and CPR is still to be possible as an efficacious treatment. So what if instead of cutting him open, we did CPR? So it's possible that this person's heart is going to come back. Right? It's very possible that it will happen, depending clearly on the patient's condition and why they're there in the first place. So we have a situation now where if we remove the ventilator and do nothing, then this patient's going to die, and we're ready to cut open his abdomen and take out his kidneys. But if we do CPR, his heartbeat will come back. So if we do CPR, it's clear at time point E that he's still alive, right? His heartbeat came back. And we know that if his heartbeat came back, so retroactively, he was still alive. So the question is, what about time D if we do nothing? Had we done CPR, it would have came back. So this patient is potentially still reversible. We're just choosing not to reverse him. Now, in fact, the protocols require in almost all hospitals, I think it's in all hospitals, I just haven't checked, is that this patient sign the DNR order. And this patient signed an order that says, do not resuscitate, do not take any means to try to resuscitate this person. So, you know, doing that in American law now is an assault. We're not going to resuscitate this patient. It's illegal. So is this person dead or alive at time point D? If I don't do the CPR, he's potentially reversible, but practically, he's not. So the bioethicists have come to a somewhat of an agreement that this is the justification for this. Well, there's two justifications for this. The first justification for this is, you know what, he's still alive. He's potentially reversible, but I don't care. I don't care because it's okay to sacrifice one person to save another. This, I find, rather distasteful and has pretty much been ridiculed in the bioethical community, is we're not going to sacrifice one person who's alive, according to everyone, because we could, if that the agreement is, he's alive, but it's okay. We're not going to sacrifice one person to save another. So what's the justification? So the justification is pretty much championed by one of the bioethicists, James Burnett. James Burnett argues that when the Uniform Determination of Death Act says that the cessation of circulation and respiration has to be irreversible, it doesn't really mean irreversible. What they mean is permanent. Irreversible means that in theory you could get it back. Permanent means that practically it's not going to happen. So in this case, practically his heartbeat is not going to come back. It stopped. CPR is illegal. It's assault. It's not going to happen. And therefore this patient is dead. So the question is, what does halakha have to say about this? Do we agree with James Burnett? Halacha certainly doesn't agree with the first logic, that it's okay to kill him even though he's alive. That has been rejected summarily by the poskim completely. So what does halacha really have to say about this? And I just want to reiterate for a moment that, in fact, this isn't a medical question. This is a halachic question. And the reason is as follows. When we want to know what it means to be dead, you have to give a value. You have to give a substantive answer, something that has a philosophical ramification, what it means to be alive and what it means to be dead. It's a question that we might disagree about because it's an opinion, it's a value judgment, it's a moral and ethical decision. It's something that a moral or ethical community has to make, a philosophical community has to make, a legal community has to make, or in our case, the halachic community has to make. It's a halachic question. A doctor can help us diagnose death. Diagnose death means, well, tell me what death is, and they'll tell you if this patient meets the criteria. The doctor will use the most high-tech instrumentation to tell us, whatever I determine to be death, is that happening in this patient right now? The doctor can answer a question of yes or no. Whatever criteria I establish, does he have a heartbeat? Well, I don't know. I can feel it, he doesn't. But if I do an EKG, I might be able to tell. Is this part of his brain particularly alive? Well, I really can't tell by standing here. I need a doctor to tell me, is this part of his brain particularly alive? And he can answer yes or no. What that means is a question of values or ethics. So in the legal community in the United States, it's a legal determination of death. It's not a medical fact. It's a legal determination. And so too in Jewish law, it's a legal determination. In Judaism, we call that halacha. So it's a legal determination of when a person is considered to be dead. And that's why there's a big disagreement about it, because it's reasonable that different people in the halachic tradition, as with all areas of halacha, will come to reasonably different conclusions. So just to reiterate now, so we have this patient who's after his heart stopped, is potentially still reversible, although we're just not going to do it. So how do we relate to that? So Shlomo Zalman Orbach, he's relating to a related but somewhat different question. He says, imagine you have two patients. They're identical. So this can't happen in reality, but imagine we have two patients who are absolutely identical, completely, all their medical needs are identical, and everything about them is similar. One is sitting at home, one is visiting his friend in the ICU. And since they're identical, the very same moment they both suffer a heart attack. They both collapse to the floor. The patient visiting his friend in the ICU collapses to the floor, and he's in the ICU. All of a sudden, the doctors come, rush over to him, get him into a bed, and start initiating CPR. And after 10 minutes, they get a heartbeat back. And after a couple of minutes, he starts breathing again. The guy who's at home, he's at home, unfortunately, Rahman al-Litzan, by himself. No EMTs are called, Hatzalah's not called, and he lays there, and he dies. So Shlomo Zalman wants to know, when did that person who was at home die? He wants to know, when do we commemorate his yahrzeit? He's particularly interested in who gets precedence over Kaddish. The family of the first guy, or the family of the second guy, depending on when they died. So he says, well, these are identical patients. This is his theory, at least. So they're identical patients. So the guy at home, in theory, he was potentially reversible for 10 minutes after he died, after his heart stopped. We know that because his friend who was in the ICU was actually reversed. So had we initiated CPR on this guy, he would have been reversed. But practically, we didn't do it. So Shlomo Zalman says, I'm not really sure. He says, it's a big suffix, I don't really know. However, as regard to the question of yahrzeit, which may be different than the question of organ donation, but as regard to the question of yahrzeit, he thinks that at least it's reasonable to say he died when he initially collapsed. And he says, why? He says the determination of death is when, according to Shlomo Zalman in this case, when the patient's heart stops and he stops breathing. That happened initially when he collapsed. He says, well, if it's reversed, then we know it wasn't irreversible. But practically, if it wasn't reversed, so then we know it was practically irreversible. It's as if he's saying the determination of death is made when the heart stops and the breathing, once the heart stops, breathing stops. So whenever I say the heart stops, I assume the breathing stopped as well in the standard heart attack case. So when the heart stops, that could be death so long as he doesn't come back. And this patient, he collapsed in his house, his heart stopped, and it never came back. So he says we go back and make that the determination of death. So if we go back to the controlled donation of the cardiac death, we have a patient whose heart stopped and it practically never came back. And therefore, you might want to say that he was dead from the original point, and then we can take out his organs after we determine that auto-resuscitation can no longer occur. Rav Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, the author of the Tzitz Eliezer, relates to a little bit of a different topic. He wants to know, how do we explain cardiac surgery? So in cardiac surgery, if a person needs, for example, a valve replacement, so what you need to do is you want to take out the old valve and put in a new valve. Now to do that, most often, we need to stop the heart. It's very hard to operate on a heart that's moving. We're starting to initiate different ways to do that, but traditionally, the heart needs to be stopped so that we can work on it effectively. It's hard to work on it while it's still pumping. So, okay, but if the heart stopped beating while in the middle of surgery, then the guy's dead and replacing his valve isn't going to help. So what we do is we put this patient on a cardiopulmonary bypass machine. That machine takes the blood before it enters the heart, takes all the blood out into a machine outside, provides it with oxygen, and puts it back into the body after the heart would have done so. And this way we can stop the heart, we can operate on the heart, we can fix it, and after the surgery is complete, we can stop the cardiopulmonary bypass machine and perform a resuscitation effectively and get that heartbeat back. Now he explains that this patient, but his heart stopped, and he wasn't breathing in the middle of the surgery. So was he dead and came back to life? So we argued before, and I think this is what all the poskim assume, that no, this patient's heart never irreversibly stopped because it came back. So long as it wasn't irreversible, and we know it came back, and hopefully this in the surgery, that the heart comes back, that's why we're doing it, this patient was never dead because it was never irreversible. Now someone asked him, yeah, well, that's a positive outcome, and we all hope for and pray for that, for a positive outcome from cardiac surgery. However, what would be the case if the patient, we couldn't get his heart back? We tried and tried and tried. We went into the surgery. We were fully confident we were going to get his heart back. We stopped his heart. We put him on the cardiopulmonary bypass machine. It was circulating oxygenated blood throughout his body. And afterwards, we tried to get his heartbeat back, and it just wasn't going. When should we determine the moment of death? Should we determine it at the moment where his heart stopped initially? or should we determine it at some point during the surgery? So it would seem that Rav Shlomo Zalman had a suffix about it, he wasn't sure. The Tzitz Eliezer is clear, he's sure. He says, wait a minute, if the heartbeat would have come back, you would have said why? Because there was some potential for reversibility that was maintained within that heart. And that's why it came back. He says, so therefore he was still alive if it comes back. So, but if it doesn't come back, at some point the potential for reversibility was there and is no longer there, right? We started the surgery knowing that it was there, knowing to the best of our ability it was there, hoping that we would be able to actualize it, but we didn't actualize it. It never happened. So he says, so long as that potential for reversibility is there, that patient is considered alive. So when his heart was stopped and he was on the cardiopulmonary bypass machine, there was some point where he was reversible. At some point it became irreversible. It's at that point that he was dead. He says, well, I don't exactly know when that point is. He says, at that point. The fact that I can't practically determine what moment that'll be is irrelevant. It's not the original moment. It's the moment that the potential for reversibility was stopped. So what would you do in Rav Shlomo Zalman's case with the Yahrzeit? I'm not exactly sure. He doesn't know exactly when it happened. He's not particularly bothered by this. But according to the Tzitz Eliezer, so in controlled donation of the cardiac death, so long as the patient's heart retains the potential for reversibility, he's alive. And if we don't do CPR, and instead of doing CPR, we try to take out his organs instead, we took out the organs of a living person, and we've killed him. So according to the Tzitz Eliezer, that should certainly be forbidden. So this has interesting philosophical ramifications for the determination of death more generally. Of course, according to the Tzitz Eliezer, right? So he says that death is determined by the moment that this patient is no longer potentially reversible. Okay, so in 2012, I can predict when that'll be. But in 1912, I probably would have predicted that would be at a different time. And in 2112, I might likely predict that it'll be at a different time. So what do you do? Historically, this will change. When we think reversibility is possible, will change with medical technology. So you could either say that, in fact, death, the determination of death, this, as regards the potential of reversibility, does in fact change. You could argue that. Alternatively, you can argue, no. It's the very potential for reversibility. In theory, you know, 100 years from now even, and today, we just don't know it, so we have to act upon what we know, but retroactively we'll know these patients were alive. That's a little bit strange. Because this begs the question then, well, what does it mean that we have the potential for reversibility, right? This patient has a DNR, so practically we're not going to do it. But we could do it. And what if I don't have the equipment? What if I'm on a desert island, but if I was on the world-class hospital in New York City, we could reverse this patient, but on my desert island I can't. Or what if I'm on the first floor of the hospital and we don't have the equipment, but on the second floor of the hospital we do have the equipment? So is death determined differently on the first floor and on the second floor? Well, it's a little bit unclear how to deal with this. And according to Rav Shlomo Zalman, that it's a simanim, so it's a little bit more clear to understand. It's when the heart stops, and the heart and breathing stop, that's when the person is considered to be dead. Well, if it comes back, so then we'll know he was reversible. If it doesn't, it's a little bit more easy to understand from a historical perspective. So the question is, halachically, does this really matter? Because clearly for the Tzitz Eliezer, this is going to be prohibited. We're taking these organs out while the patient is potentially reversible. The Tzitz Eliezer says that the moment of death is determined when the patient is no longer potentially reversible, so if you take out the organs before that time, you've killed him and it's forbidden. According to Rav Shlomo Zalman, we said that it's when the heart stops beating and the breathing stops, that the patient is dead, so long as he's not reversed. So this patient wasn't reversed, so what's the problem? So I think there are really potentially two problems with this approach. The first is, well, who says that your agreement not to do anything matters? Maybe he thinks that it matters only whether it's possible to be done, although it seems to be more of a practical concern. The second question is, well, what about going forward? That's nice. So if someone says, well, if the heart stops and it's never actually reversed, so then we know retroactively that that was the time that he was dead. But I know that retroactively. But going forward, as I'm in the moment, I don't actually know if it's going to be reversed or not. It may be reversed, it may not be reversed. Someone may come and do CPR. Is it sufficient that we've decided that we won't do it to say, well, okay, so it's not going to happen? In theory, it's still possible. So Rav Shlomo Zalman may be making a retroactive judgment that, well, after it wasn't reversed, I know that it was initially he was dead at the original time. But it doesn't mean that going forward we're going to allow this. Because going forward, we still have to be concerned that it'll be reversed. So I think according to Rav Shlomo Zalman, even then it's not clear that this is going to be something that we can rely on to allow controlled donation after cardiac death. This leaves aside the question of removing the ventilator. which is going to be a separate problem, both according to Rosh Zalman and according to the Sizzle. So there are poskim who are going to allow it. But leaving that aside for a moment, and leaving aside some other issues of preparing the person for this beforehand, which may or may not involve halachic questions, leaving that aside, I think according to the Tzitz Eliezer, this patient is going to be alive. According to Rosh Zalman, this patient is going to be alive. You had a question?
Yes, what do you do with cardiac donation with cardiac death?
So it's not going to work.
What?
So practically, when we do this protocol, because we've waited 5 minutes, the heart is no longer transplantable. The survivability of the heart is no longer...
But the three cases of low momentum that they used...
They did. It was. It was. Right.
So theoretically, now you have a real problem because you're restarting the same heart but a different person.
Absolutely. So Loma Linda, I believe, is in New Mexico. Was that the case I was referring to?
California.
I apologize. It was those three cases that were fought in New England Journal of Medicine where they waited the 75 seconds. Many people were upset about that case for two reasons. First of all, they waited 75 seconds, which was not based on data. And second of all, in children, the assumption is, again, I don't know how well-founded this is, because autoresuscitation data is not easy to come by, that children's organs are much more susceptible to autoresuscitation. I don't know how well-founded that is in data or not, but the assumption was that they waited too short of a time, and there's been a question whether we should really stop doing these pediatric cases, because we just don't know, and we need a longer time. So in this case, yeah, well, this heart was eventually restarted, but this is the case, every heart that you're going to transplant is eventually restarted, so you're going to have to deal with that question. But here, at least, yeah, this heart was clearly, with these babies, so after they waited 75 seconds, this heart was clearly still capable of potential reversibility, and we know that because it reversed another patient. So according to the Tzitz Eliezer, that was certainly forbidden. And according to many bioethicists, I think even Dr. Burnett was opposed to that, and he thought that they should have certainly waited a little bit longer. Okay. So that's, yes? Other infants. Yeah. Right. The definition of brain death for newborns, I think for children in general, is somewhat vague still at this point, because especially as regards to the irreversibility notion of it, especially in terms of testing for it, it's, and in fact, in my book I don't address children at all because of the difficulty in precisely determining the moment in science that we know that this patient meets whatever criteria you're going to establish for the brain is very hard to know, especially in newborns. I think even in older children, that we don't know exactly when it happens. So I don't really want to address that point because we don't have the facts. So I'm more interested in addressing the halacha where we have the facts. Once we know the facts, then we can apply it to the halacha and see what the halacha would say. But unfortunately, I think the facts are still muddled and we're still awaiting a resolution on that. So controlled donation after cardiac death is something that's being done. Again, I don't think it's being done quite so much. It's being done in New York City, but not very much. So there's been another attempt to do something a little bit different, called uncontrolled donation after cardiac death. So uncontrolled because, in this case, the person is dying, not within the confines of the operating room. So this person, and the protocol was established as a protocol around Bellevue Hospital recently, a couple of months ago, and is already established in Washington, D.C., and in Spain and other European countries, this is prevalent. So you have a patient who experiences a heart attack, a witnessed heart attack. We know their heart stopped. They were functional before, and then their heart stopped. Someone called the EMTs, and the EMTs tried to resuscitate this person and failed. So they failed. So now, well, what can we do? Well, if we rush this patient to the hospital, it's just not going to be enough time. If we're taking the patient from the ICU to the operating room, it's going to be too much time. So depending on where this person is, rushing him to the hospital is not really a solution. So what can you do? So this person has tried CPR. His heart stopped. It was flatline. We tried CPR and it failed. So this patient's heart is not reversible, right? Because we tried to reverse it. We're assuming we tried to the best of our abilities using the most modern techniques available. And we couldn't restart the heart. So according to the Tzitz Eliezer, the potential for reversibility is gone. According to Rosh Zalman Orbach, this patient is certainly dead. So is there something that we can do to try to salvage this patient's organs? So what they've tried to establish in this protocol around Bellevue Hospital involves the organ preservation unit. So what they want to do is take a patient who's died, according to all criteria, right? His heart is irreversibly stopped. Right, irreversibly. We know it's irreversible. Is there some way to maintain the viability of his kidneys? So what they've established is this organ preservation unit. It looks oddly like an ambulance, but it's not actually. It is saving lives, just not the person who's life is in the ambulance, and they're going to try their best to try to keep these organs going as long as they can, even though this person is dead according to all standards. So the way they do that is the following. So you have this person who's dead, so he's a corpse, right? He's dead. And what we're going to try to do is, well, if I take the dead person and I tilt him back and forth, so blood is going to flow, right? Blood is going to flow to his head, and then back to his feet, back to his head, and back to his feet. Now this person is experiencing circulation, right? Blood is circulating, but nothing is happening spontaneously on his own. This person is dead with circulating blood. Now what happens if I breathe into his mouth every couple of minutes, or every couple of seconds? Excuse me. So this person clearly is still dead, but now I've managed to maybe, hopefully, oxygenate that blood that's circulating throughout his body. So maybe, if I use a little bit more high-tech techniques than tilting this guy and breathing into his mouth every couple of seconds, I can create oxygenated blood flowing through his arteries. Now, nothing is happening on its own. It's all completely artificial. The same way you would take the hands of a corpse and put them together like this, you wouldn't say the corpse is clapping. So to here, he's not experiencing anything. His heart will never beat again. This man is not breathing. But I might be able to maintain the viability of his cells. So the more high-tech way that they do this is called a thumper. A thumper presses on the guy's chest quickly and squishes the chest cavity to push blood out of the heart. The heart, again, will never beat again on its own. It is irreversibly stopped. We put the patient on the ventilator eventually to oxygenate the blood more effectively than mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and we manage, or the hope is, that we manage to create enough oxygenated blood flowing through his arteries that will keep the kidneys alive. I believe that, so the protocol was, so we still, this is not like, this isn't going to keep him alive for very long. So the protocol so far has only been in effect in New York within a 10-minute ambulance drive from Bellevue Hospital, because this hasn't been perfected sufficiently to allow it from a farther distance. So far, I believe as of last week, there have not been any patients who met the criteria for this. And in this way, though, in Spain, they managed to do this, and they managed to maintain at least the kidneys again, which are the most versatile organs after the heart has stopped spontaneously beating, to be able to transplant them into patients who don't so desperately need them. And again, those are the number one needed organs. So the question is, there are many, many concerns with this protocol, many of whom which dealt with by the Bellevue Committee, many of which have been dealt with in Spain and Washington, D.C. The first question is, when do you stop doing CPR? How do you know when CPR has failed? So this is a question that arises in every case of CPR and has been dealt with, and the EMTs have their own protocols to establish, well, depending on the conditions, when we can assume that CPR is no longer effective. So whenever CPR is no longer effective, we can assume at that point that the heart has irreversibly stopped. Now, as a safeguard, to make sure that no one, God forbid, stops CPR prematurely in the hope of transplanting these organs, meaning effectively sacrificing this guy's life, the patient in front of us, at least passively, for the help of somebody else, they've tried to establish two separate teams. The team that does the CPR is not the team that's preserving the organs. They don't even know. There are only a limited number of organ preservations that can happen per day. So the team that's doing the CPR doesn't even know if this patient is going to be eligible for the organ preservation protocol. So they really have no incentive of stopping early. But we're assuming everyone's a good person, everyone wants to save lives, and so there's a question when to stop CPR. The second issue is consent for organ preservation. So in brain death, at least, the patient is usually in the ICU, is diagnosed as being brain dead, and even perhaps a little bit before, the doctors have a hunch that this is what's going to happen. The person is relatively stable for at least a moderate period of time. You can at least talk to the family. You have the opportunity to find out what was this patient's wishes. Did he wish to donate his organs or not? Because you need consent. And you at least have, it's not a very long period, but you at least have time, usually at least, to speak and find out what this patient's wishes were. The problem with uncontrolled donation of cardiac death is this patient just collapsed on the floor. We don't know what his status is. The EMTs arrive. They do not know this patient at all. And the person who's standing there, someone called 911, may not know this patient well at all. So do we have consent to try to preserve his organs, at least? Even if we won't take them out without full consent, can we preserve them? And so the protocol tried to make the legal argument that legally it's permissible to preserve this person's organs so long as you don't know that he didn't want it. So that if, should this protocol come into effect, and the patient's lying there, and we don't know that he doesn't want to do it, person always can say no, can always not consent, then they're allowed to preserve his organs. They can't take them out without consent, but they can at least preserve it, preserve the organs by putting on the thumper and the ventilator without consent. This was one of the most contentious issues in the New York City protocol. It was fought about a lot, and I think this was really one of the major factors in whether it happened or not. From a halachic perspective, there's a machlokas. Do you need consent from the person to take his organs, or do you need consent from his family? So the person who's lying there, regardless whether he's cardiac death, or for those poskim who hold of brain death, if he's brain dead, the person can't speak on his own. So he may have made his wishes known before, he may have made his wishes known to a family member, and then he can express those. But let's say the person didn't make his wishes known, so there's a machlokas haposkim whether you actually need consent or not, or do you say, wait, this person's dead. Once he's dead, now, it's nivel ames, so we're not allowed to do it, but for the purpose of pikuach nefesh. So the question is it considered to be stealing from the person? Am I stealing his organs and giving them to somebody else, which may or may not be prohibited? The poskim debate this issue often in most secular law, both in America and in Israel. I believe in most European countries, it's not permissible without consent. You may not remove a person's organs without their own consent or their surrogate's consent, so it's not much of an issue. But halachically, there is a disagreement between Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Moshe Feinstein, whether consent is absolutely necessary or not. The last issue of concern for uncontrolled donation after cardiac death is brain death. And what I mean is, for those poskim who hold of brain death, there is a position within that that says there's actually only one definition of death. The only definition of death is brain death. And you know why, when the heart stops, a person's dead? Is because their brain has died as well. There's no oxygenated blood flowing to their brain, and so the brain has died as well. The concern in this case would be, yes, this person's heart stopped and they stopped breathing, but should we provide oxygenated blood to that person, perhaps whatever areas of the brain that we're going to consider necessary for the determination of brain death may still be viable. It's a question. We don't know. So this is not only a question in halacha, it's also a question in ethics. And so to avoid that problem, the Bellevue Protocol insisted that before they initiate anything, they do a rudimentary brain death exam. So normally a brain death exam requires, in most hospitals, requires to be done twice. You're only going to do it once. We're going to do a rudimentary assessment by the EMTs who are trained to do this, and we're going to try to see, well, this patient isn't breathing on their own, so we know that. And they check the reflexes to see if they're reflexing or not, and the assumption is if they fail that, they are going to be brain dead as well, and therefore dead according to both requirements of the UDDA, the Universal Determination of Death Act, and so it won't be a problem. Because if their brain was still alive, but their heart wasn't working, so then they meet one set of criteria, but not another, which would be sufficient, but this really bothered some people, that if you meet one criteria, not the other, it bothered a lot of bioethicists. I don't think any halachic poskim were involved in this Bellevue Protocol, but there are many ethicists and many community organizations, again, not necessarily Jewish community organizations, which are very bothered by this. And so they initiated this requirement, again, in the Bellevue. I don't know what happens in Washington. I don't believe it's the case in Washington, to obviate this problem. So from a halachic perspective, it seems at least that uncontrolled donation after cardiac death is fine. This person has irreversibly died. There is no potential for his heart coming back. There is no potential for him breathing ever again. The only questionable point is whether or not this patient is brain dead. And in the Bellevue Protocol, at least we try to get around that by making sure that he is. And this should at least be some hope that we can at least try to save as many lives as possible through this person's kidneys. And the hope is, I think, that one day we'll try to find a way where we can expand this from the 10-minute radius of Bellevue Hospital, where we can find some way, because the simplest source of getting organs is from dead people. People die all the time. And more than 90,000 people die in the United States a year. If we were able to at least try to take advantage of that, we may be able to cure at least the kidney problem, maybe the heart problem, depending on how we're going to define the protocol. So for uncontrolled donation, the hearts will not survive, but the kidneys might. And so hopefully that might be a resolution to part of this problem. Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to take questions if anyone has. Okay. So, yes?
Can I ask some questions about the book?
Sure. So, just one moment. The book is available downstairs for purchase. The Sfarim sale policy was that I could not sell them from the room. There are two here for anyone who wants to look at them. And I will be signing them downstairs if anyone wants to look and wants to purchase one. And I urge you to go downstairs to do that. Yes, sir?
I have a number of questions about the book. I'll ask one.
Okay, otherwise we can talk about it after, sure.
In your book you mentioned that you prefer not to deal with any oral testimony but only written testimony.
Yeah.
You refer in your book to the fact that there might be some conflicting positions that are Moshe Feinstein's position.
In fact.
And you said if there's any oral testimonies, that was dealt with the Bush document that was put out by the RCA last year.
I didn't mean exhaustively, but they did deal with it effectively.
But actually, it wasn't exhaustively. There are seven living people, seven doctors who are alive today. Six are Jewish and one is not Jewish, who are alive today. Some live in Jerusalem, some live in the tri-state area, one is in Florida. All that testify, they spoke to their Moshe Feinstein, and he told them that brainstem death was a lucky death, you should donate organs even if it's the heart. And six of them who were Jewish all said they understood Yiddish. So my question to you is, why is it when you analyze your Moshe's Piskei Teshuva in your book, you don't look at any of the oral testimony, you say it's a little bit confusing, and therefore we can't really say what Moshe held one or the other?
So, as I noted in the introduction to the book, my book is not interested in Paschal Halach. I'm not a posek. I think that this issue needs to be determined, just like you would want the most expert doctor to perform the heart surgery, I think you would want the most expert posek to answer the shiloh. Rav Moshe Feinstein was certainly one of them. I am certainly not.
Right, there's a question of halacha. There's a question of what, historical accuracy.
Right, so there
what
is some... You're right. Unfortunately, with his passing, we cannot ask him. He has written positions on the matter, which are accessible, and we can read them, and indeed, people who have come to conflicting conclusions. People who have spoke to him, indeed, came to conflicting conclusions. I understand that there are many people who think...
I'm not aware of one person who has spoken to him. There are people who have read his truth who come to conflicting conclusions.
Well, there are.
One person who has spoken
I'm not, to him... I'm not going... To, I've spoken to people who have spoken with him. I've spoken to people who have poskened to him. There are many, many, many poskim. Other rabbis in the community... I'm sorry. There are many rabbis in the community who, when this issue happened... and they asked Rav Moshe what to do, he said that this patient wasn't dead. And I understand that people disagree, and they disagree about what he told them. So I'm not coming to a conclusion of what he says. I don't think that's advisable. If a person wants to say that I'm relying on the testimony of X, who's a reliable person who said that Rav Moshe said yes, or Rav Moshe said no, I think that's fine. I was trying to understand the halachic issue. Whether Rav Moshe said yes or whether he said no doesn't really interest me so much. I want to know, try to understand his position best. So if he said yes, why did he say yes? And if he said no, why did he say no? And that's why in these oral testimonies, usually that's not the content of it. It's usually either yes or no. But I was more interested in trying to understand the issue, and I think that you get that more from his written tshuvas, at least some of them, where he analyzes the issue in some detail. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Does anyone use that line to talk about CPR and to say that in the context of CPR, you never can be absolutely certain that CPR is going to work or not work, and therefore that you might be able to define death prior to when CPR would no longer work because it wouldn't be certain, and Tosos can say that certainty is required.
Right. So that line in Tosos, as I mentioned, is a little bit difficult because by Pikuach Nefesh we assume even a suffix. So the question is, why does Tosfos make bar? And there are different answers given, but I haven't seen anyone use that because that Tosfos is so difficult on the face of it. Because Pikuach Nefesh, we pask in Halacha L'maisa, it's clear in the Gemara and Yoma, it's clear in the Shulchan Aruch, that any time you have the potential to save a life, you can violate Shabbos, you can violate Yom Kippur, you can violate any Yisrael Torah, save the three cardinal sins for that purpose. So this certainty is not necessary, Halacha L'maisa. So I haven't seen anyone use this, though. That would be an interesting suggestion. Yes, sir. Auto-resuscitation.
I also was under the impression that when bioethicists talk about just morally, they think that there should be a visual separation between death and the next process.
Absolutely.
But is that because of auto-resuscitation, or is that two separate things?
So I'm not sure why. There's disagreements among the bioethicists again. So all of them agree that auto-resuscitation would be a potential problem for this determination. Some also want to advocate an additional waiting period because it's just morally... it feels wrong. So in order, again, to allow this, there are usually two separate teams. One determines death. The other one procures the organs. The organ procurement team is not allowed into the room until after it's been accomplished to try to separate it as much as possible. But I don't know how you would give a precise number to that. And especially if lives are on the line, I don't know that that's your moral qualms. If the person is legally dead, halachically dead, I don't know that your moral qualms are going to stand in the way of saving a life. For auto-resuscitation, it depends. I think it would depend on Machlokas Sicilias and Rosalma Salomon. And again, I think according to Rosalma Salomon, it would still be prohibited going forward. We only know retroactively that it was. Yes?
So, if you have have somebody who died and he had a son who didn't have a yerusha, and organs are still available. So is it up to the son? Is he obtained those because they were property of the father, or it's his decision what to do with them?
So legally, it's his decision what to do with them, unless that person made his wishes clear beforehand. Very clear beforehand. Legally, that is, I believe that's true. Halachically, so I said again, it's a machlokas where someone was on the Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks that it's up to the family to decide, not because they have ownership or bialos over those organs, but because they're responsible for the burial. And therefore, if you remove them to take to somebody else, you're preventing them from performing a mitzvah. Problem is, but I'm allowed to prevent someone from performing a mitzvah with the purpose of Pikuach Nefesh, so Rav Moshe doesn't really get into it. Rav Zalman thinks that you don't need permission, it's Pikuach Nefesh. It doesn't belong to anybody, the man's dead. The children don't inherit the organs, they're not property, and so you wouldn't need that consent. But legally, you need consent in all jurisdictions, so it's somewhat of a moot point. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you to Rabbi Dr. David Shabtai. Thank you all for coming. Please feel free to take more food. And we're also having a Gift of Life bone marrow swabbing. If anyone hasn't swabbed yet, as part of the registry, it's right outside in the hallway opposite the elevators. Have a good night.
And the books are available again downstairs.